night. We did not know at the time what was happening at Broadway Lafayette subway stop, but Jordan Neely was killed by another passenger. He was black. He was unhoused. You tweeted, being black and poor in America should not be crimes punishable by vigilante death.
And that is exactly the question about how the lack of accountability for taking black lives extends to this current moment. We have to worry not only about police officers taking our lives, but individuals thinking that they're empowered enough to exact discipline, to exact lethal punishment for the possibility that they might be in fear of someone who needed help rather than needed death.
Kimberly Crenshaw, I want to thank you so much for being with us, Executive Director of African American Policy Forum, professor at UCLA and Columbia University. By the way, a very happy birthday to you. And thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Soul Queens and Blues Kings, making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Norman Boogie Cat Sylvester and Band bring together regional rhythm and blues acts for a night of music and dance as a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon. Again, that's Soul Queens and Blues Kings making a real concert on Sunday, May 7th from 4:30 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Support for this program comes from KBOO members and from the League of Women Voters of Portland, providing nonpartisan election information for the May special election at lwvpdx.org. The website has explanations of ballot measures on services for renters and for children and public safety. The League informs voters because every vote matters.
Hi, this is Judy Collins, and you're listening to KBOO in Portland.
Good morning. You are listening to KBOO Portland. This is The Gap. My name is Tammy, and with me is the lovely co-host, Althea Billing.
Hello and good morning. How you doing, Tammy?
I'm doing well. I'm super excited because we have guests today.
Yes, we have a fabulous show lined up for you this morning. Very exciting. This is The Gap Friday Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland. We like to do a two-parter type of show, so in our first half, we'll do a news roundup in this town. There's always news to round up. Or we're doing an interview like we are today. And in the second half is when we open up our phone lines for you, the listener, to turn Alchemy-like into a caller to answer our community question. And our lovely guests have agreed to take questions with us today, so I won't keep you in suspense too much longer, but we're very, very excited. We are speaking today with the volunteer campaign coordinators for Eviction Representation for All, Colleen Carroll and John Bethencourt. Welcome, folks.
Hello.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, we're so happy to have you. You are working on Measure 26238, which is on the ballot. I mean, people should have gotten their ballots by now, but we got... Turn it around, you know. It's about time to start sending them in. Where do you want to start, Tammy? Where should we go first?
Well, ERA's been doing some really great work, and now with upcoming elections, there are some measures on the ballot. So we'll be talking about that in just a bit. But for starters, maybe folks haven't heard of Eviction Representation for All. Why don't you tell us a little bit about who you are and what ERA does?
Sure. Thanks so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here and be looking you in the eyes, you over there as well. So eviction representation for all would provide free universal legal representation to every tenant who is facing an eviction in Multnomah County. Because the eviction process happens through the civil court proceedings, people are not guaranteed legal representation or a lawyer the way that we think, you know, every time you go to court, you're provided the right to a lawyer. And in civil proceedings, that's not true. And civil proceedings are things that are really, really important. And eviction is one of those things, right? The eviction proceedings are extremely technical. I've spent hundreds of hours in eviction court over the past 3 years. And one thing that always happens is the judge says at the top of the docket, this is an extremely technical process. Most of the cases will either end on a procedural failing, which are things like default evictions, which happen to 1 in 4 people who are served with an eviction notice. They lose before a single hearing has been heard. The case is won just because it was filed. Mm. And so obviously having a lawyer represent you would stop 1/4 of all of the evictions that happen in our community, which is massive. And then if you make it past that default place, you are almost guaranteed to get moved into what's called a stipulated agreement, which is a negotiation that happens with your landlord's lawyer, because landlords also do not want to do the legal proceeding on their own. They hire lawyers or eviction specialists, which are people called agents, which it's important to know that tenants don't have the right to hire. The law has made it possible for landlords to hire non-lawyer eviction specialists. Why not tenants? But we can't. So we have to negotiate agreements with the landlord's lawyer in, you know, about 5 minutes in the hallway. And those are coercive and could be really important eviction diversion mechanisms, but right now are just fast tracking the process. And so providing legal representation to every tenant in eviction court is something that started in New York City, pushed really by the tenants movement. This is something that tenants have known for a really long time is super unfair, and right to counsel started in New York City and is spread throughout the United States, Kansas City, Philadelphia, San Francisco, lots and lots of places. And so we're trying to bring that here, building on those programs. Most importantly, well, two things most importantly, is that it's universal. So people do not have to prove that they deserve due process. And that it pairs it with emergency rental system and some legal fund to reduce the punitive liens that tenants get when they have an eviction filed against them. And so it's really an ecosystem of eviction prevention and diversion that is tenant-centered and paid for by a 0.75, so less than 1% capital gains tax.
Thank you for that rundown there. Can you talk a little bit about where this movement started? Obviously, you mentioned New York, but talking specifically about here in Multnomah County, you mentioned 3 years ago. People can maybe rewind the clock to remember what 2020 was like. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Sure. If we turn our minds back. I think that there was a lot of, you know, talk about eviction moratoriums, and there was a moment in the pandemic where we realized how many tenants are precariously housed, right? That missing 1 month's rent is a fast track to eviction. I think that's something that also comes up a lot, where people are saying, well, you know, a lot of evictions are filed for non-payment of rent. And I think we have to distinguish, like really sit with ourselves and think for a minute. There's a difference between a story where a tenant has just decided to refuse to pay rent and says, I'm never paying rent ever again in my whole entire life, right? Or somebody who has to choose between a medical bill, choose between, in the pandemic, it was not going to work in unsafe conditions, right? Mm-hmm. Or getting laid off, right? That first month that you miss your rent, it doesn't matter how many months you have paid, you know, dutifully and on time before, there is no credit, right? There's no credit system for, you know, good behavior. It's just that first month where you're late and now you have a non-payment of eviction. Or if you've paid partial rent, and if you are able to say, hey, I had to make a choice. My car broke down. My kid needed to go to the doctor. Next month, I'm able to pay rent on time, in full, again, that doesn't matter. And so, another thing that we're seeing is that a lot of landlords are moving to portal systems, so online systems, so people can't pay with cash, people can't pay with checks, people have to walk down to the local 7-Eleven and use their iPhone Apple Pay to, like, you know, pay the 7-Eleven that's going to pay the landlord digitally, right? And these portal systems are set up so that if at the stroke of midnight on the fourth day, they automatically trigger that eviction.
I've had that experience.
There you go, right? And so you wake up, so it's these automatic things, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that why we're seeing the rates of eviction increase coming out of the pandemic, because more and more of this landlord tech is facilitating the fast moving of evictions. So here we go. We go back. We're back in 2020, and people are realizing for the first time that this is really harmful, and we can't. It's, you know, unsustainable. And so there was this moment where the idea of what would it look like to live without, you know, this massive pressure and in this all this instability. And I think the governments, you know, right, tried to take that seriously. And there's this question about eviction moratoriums. Now, very, very quickly, it became clear that it was not an eviction, a moratorium on evictions. It was a very small, narrow slice of evictions that weren't able to be filed. But so me and a group of people met online because we started hearing about how the eviction courts were up and running, even though there was this moratorium on evictions. So we asked, like, what's that about? Right? Like, mm-hmm. When you see that kind of contradiction, you kind of go, what's up? And so we started attending eviction court. And, you know, I have to say it was one of those first 3 days was one of the most radicalizing experiences I've ever had. And I've been in a lot of, right, struggles and fights and things that I care really deeply about. Mm-hmm. But I had never seen a bureaucratic system work so efficiently to ruin people's lives. Mm-hmm. Right? It was self-aware. The system was self-aware that it was unfair, unjust, and it just kept going. And so coming out of that, you know, we started, you know, doing some eviction defense work. We started working and reaching out to other people who cared a lot about working class issues and preventing harm and homelessness saw what was happening in other jurisdictions. Kansas City at the time had a really strong, continues to have a really strong tenants movement. Mm. And was passing eviction representation for all in their communities. And it turned into like a political education study group. So it was a group of tenants who got together and studied really hard, looked at the working models and said, what's working? What can we bring here? And what can we improve upon? And that was about a 4-month political, you know, education study group. And coming out of that, we decided that we were going to move a ballot measure because it allowed us to build the program that we knew would work. That turned into the Eviction Representation for All Coalition, the core members. And then that group has grown, and we're now up to over 70 endorsements of organizations who see how housing security really, really matters, whether it's unions or teachers or faith communities who see that securing people's housing is the way that we can make sure that so many other things that we care about become possible to fight for. We cannot, you know, it becomes really a lot harder to fight for anything else when you are not stably housed. Mm-hmm. That's kind of how, and I guess, John, if you want to talk a little bit about coming on board, I think your story is a little bit different and really interesting about how we kind of merged here.
Yeah, so I've been with the campaign a little less time than Colleen, about a year and a half now. I came through it through DSA, Democratic Socialists of America, which has brought us many of our volunteers. And, you know, my interest and background wasn't necessarily in eviction specifically, which, you know, I know Colleen studies professionally. It was more in kind of grassroots organizing. I'd previously worked on another ballot initiative campaign launched by a bunch of DSA folks and others who formed a coalition to create universal preschool in this area. So that campaign ran for about three or four years. And, you know, that was kind of a first for many of us. We had never really worked closely on a campaign. Maybe we'd gone out and knocked some doors here and there, but that was kind of our first time really crafting a policy and building a coalition around it and seeing it through from start to finish. So we gathered signatures. We got on the ballot for November of 2020, and it eventually passed. And the story is a little complicated because there was another preschool expansion effort called Preschool for All. Our campaign was called Universal Preschool Now. And then at the same time, one of the county commissioners, Jessica Vega Peterson, was pursuing her own effort to expand preschool. It wasn't necessarily envisioned to be a universal program. So those efforts kind of continued in parallel for a while. And then we got our measure on the ballot and then kind of negotiated an agreement to combine our efforts and create a unified system for universal preschool, incorporating the best of both proposals. And that's what ended up passing and becoming law. So a lot of folks from that campaign, having wrapped that up just over a couple years ago, were looking for something else to do, another unmet community need to organize around and, you know, meet people and make change. So many of us have come over and started working on ERA at this point.
Very cool.
Can I add a little moment to
sure,
that?
Sure.
Yeah, I think one of the things that one of the things that happened there was in the group that was looking to develop the program, we had met with Stout Financial, which is a financial firm that has done a lot of cost benefit analyses and evaluations of eviction representation for all like programs across the country. And you can go to their website. If you look up Stout Financial eviction representation, you'll find many, many published reports. So we were working with them to help us cost out the program. They met with us pro bono. That was very cool. And we were also talking with looking at kind of the budget as it is now and what was being funded to provide a small increase in eviction representation during the pandemic. And we were talking with elected politicians and saying, like, what do you think about this program? What would you think about actually making a universal program? And one of the things that we heard a lot of was, how are you going to pay for it, right? The idea of passing an unfunded ballot measure was really was undesirable, and we also can look to some of the other programs that did that in San Francisco and in Kansas City and in Baltimore and in Detroit, where they passed an unfunded program, and those programs were underfunded, delayed in getting started, right? Like, it was almost like a paper promise, but very hard to fulfill because, in fact, you know, important services cost money, and so people were saying, "How are you going to pay for it? How are you going to pay for it?" And so our group got together and said, "Okay, well, how do we want to pay for this?" And we worked with John and Mary King and several other people, I think, who got together and said, what is an equitable way to pay for a program like this? And they did a ton of work looking back at and identified capital gains. And the Oregon Center for Public Policy has also, separate from the campaign, released a report that identifies capital gains as a driver of inequality, especially in Oregon, but I think nationally as well. And so that group helped us to identify, and by that time, I think John was now on the campaign, right? Like, identified capital gains as a type of income or of money making that is undertaxed at the federal level and is a driver of wealth inequality and social inequality. And that's how we came to identify that as a way. And because very few people make a ton of money, we didn't really have to raise the amount that is would be collected by very much. It's less than 1%. And so I think it's important to talk about the real, like, you know, the decision that capital gains are unequally spread out in our community, and that, you know, that's a reasonable way to pay for really important social services in our community.
Tammy?
Oh, thank you so much. That's really great and interesting stuff. And just hearing you talk about eviction court, I could hear the pain that, you know, of what you had to see and see other people endure. And so fast forwarding to now, where we're at, special elections coming up May 16th, and ERA has a measure up for voting, measure 26238. Can you please talk about it, describe it to us, and explain to us exactly why you decided to go the capital gains tax, and what is capital gains taxes?
Yeah, I can take this one. So you know, the measure that we ended up crafting with our coalition is just what Colleen described, guarantees a right to counsel for everyone in eviction court, and beyond that creates this ecosystem of early interventions and other services to help keep tenants who are going through a tough time housed until they can stabilize and hopefully keep them off the streets. And as to the tax, yeah, to fund it, like Colleen said, yeah, there were several important reasons that led us to an increase in the tax on capital gains. So what is a capital gain? A capital gain is a profit you make when you sell an investment asset. So most capital gains come from the sale of stocks or bonds or other securities. So if you buy a stock for $100 and then a couple of years later you sell it for $120, then that's a $20 capital gain. So that's a form of income you have. And that's a form of investment income in contrast to what the IRS calls earned income. So earned income is wages, salaries, tips. And those are the amounts that you pay regular income tax on. Mm-hmm. Capital gains is separate from that, and you pay a different tax on that, the federal capital gains tax. And it's, like Colleen said, it's a much lower rate. It's typical for someone to maybe pay, you know, half as much capital gains tax on the same amount of money that they would pay if that were earned income, which really seems wildly unfair when you think about it. I mean, most people earn their money by working. So why should we have this system where people who get most of their income just from sitting passively on investment portfolios are taxed at a far lower rate? So by increasing the capital gains tax at the local level, you know, we knew this measure would close that inequitable gap just a little bit. You know, it's less than a 1% increase, 0.75%. But still, we thought that that met our equity goals well. And there were, you know, there were other possibilities we considered. You know, some other similar campaigns elsewhere in the country have looked to tax landlords or apartment building owners in some way to fund a program of this type. Maybe you pay a tax if you own more than a certain number of rental units, which is not a terrible idea, but that does raise the question of, well, if it's a tax only on rental units specifically, what if people just kind of pass that expense on through to the through the rents, through higher rents, in which case, you know, the tenant may end up paying for the representation in the end anyway, which would defeat the purpose. Mm. So we wanted a broader base tax across an entire class of investment income so we could keep the rate low and minimize those types of economic distortions. And it's also something that people are already reporting in their federal taxes. Anyone can look at their Form 1040 and look at the line that says capital gains. Mm-hmm. And for about 85% of tax filers, that line says zero. Most mm-hmm. people don't have any capital gains. You know, there's a small number of middle class folks who have like a small amount of capital gains here and there. And for those folks, you know, this won't make a very big difference because the rate is so low. Mm-hmm. And then you have the top 1% who captures more than half of all capital gains. And those are the ones who'll really pay. And again, they won't be soaked. You know, the rate is low. But that's where a lot of the funding is going to come from. And there's a couple important exemptions from paying capital gains tax that exist at the federal level that we designed this measure to preserve. So one is retirement accounts. So you don't pay capital gains tax on capital gains within an IRA, either Roth or traditional or a 401k. So these tax-deferred retirement accounts, that's totally separate. So if you have investments in one of those, you don't need to worry about this tax increase. It won't affect you. That's one exception. The other exemption that exists at the federal level is for selling your principal residence. So if you have a home you've lived in for some period of time and you sell it and, you know, say you bought a house for $400,000, and then down the road, you sell it for $850,000. So now you have a capital gain of $450,000. If you're a couple who's bought and sold the house at those prices, you would owe no capital gains tax because there is an exemption of $500,000 mm-hmm. which is the amount of profit you can have buying and selling your principal residence without paying any capital gains tax. So that just ensures that kind of, you know, regular middle class folks don't need to worry about, you know, paying a tax on their home. Of course, you know, a lot of people aren't lucky enough to own their home, which is really what this measure is aimed at. Mm-hmm. But unless you have a portfolio of multiple homes as investments, or, you know, a home that's worth millions of dollars, you know, where you could have a profit so large that you get beyond that limit,
right?
That's not something you have to worry about.
Right. Well, I wanna turn now, you know, to this moment where we are in the campaign. Obviously, folks got their ballots and their information packets recently, and that shows, you know, both the comments in support and comments in opposition. Let's talk about the opposition to this measure. Who are they and what do they object to?
Yeah, I think coming out of what John was just saying, I want to lift up a statement of support we recently got from Brad Twist, who's the owner of a local realtor company called Neighbors Realty, so right, a local business. And he writes, most of my sellers don't pay capital gains on the sale of their home, as there are important exclusions in the tax code. The majority of people paying capital gains on real estate are investors, flippers, and landlords selling real estate. And that's who we see. So that's the group that we see in opposition, right? Mm-hmm. As well as people who know that the money that they make on corporate stocks and bonds will be slightly impacted by this measure. It's important to remember that, yes, talking about the question of people's homes really matters. And we've spent a lot of time on the campaign talking about that. Mm-hmm. But as much time as we spend talking about that, we are not talking about the other forms of capital gains that are not possibly exempted, you know, will not be exempted, which are corporate stocks and bonds, right? And so that makes up 2/3 of capital gains nationally, right? So that really is, so when we look at the opposition, it's realtors, landlords, people who make money flipping houses. I know that that's been a real problem, obviously, in Portland for a long time, but also nationally, about the kind of hoarding and quick inflation of, trend-based gentrification, I guess, is the best way that I can say it, which is, you know, buying a house and then flipping it for, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars within months or within years, right? That's the type of equity that people who are flippers, landlords, real estate agents, and people who invest in properties are stealing out of our community. And so wealth management firms, right? We look at the opposition is heavily funded by out-of-state real estate interests. Their largest donation was $250,000 from the National Realtors Association, wealth management firms, landlords, developers. I think that they are really afraid that not only the people of Portland and Multnomah County and Oregon, but that grassroots organizing across the United States will realize that capital gains are a way, taxing capital gains is a way that we could pay for important measures. We are told, you know, fight for general funding, go, you know, use what's already available, figure out how you're going to pay for it, right? That contradiction of both, like, figure out how you're going to pay for it and fight amongst yourselves for the general funding that exists, mm-hmm. as opposed to saying, what if there was more money available? Through to pay for the important government services? What if we didn't have to shut down libraries to pay, you know, to increase the police budget? What if we didn't have to, you know, shut down important student and school programs, as we're seeing happening across the United States, to make these compromises? What if there was just a little bit more money available to pay for the things that will make our lives livable? And I think that nationally, people who make capital gains don't want to see a single local measure succeed, because then, you know, that first moment of bravery. I think this is something that lots and lots of people who I respect and admire in organizing, and we talk in our campaign a lot, which is like, we have to be brave and we have to be brave together. Organizing is about, you know, collective bravery, collective skill building, and standing up to powerful interests together. And what we have done over the 2 years and the coalition that we've built here has done that. And I think I know that other right to counsel measures and other tenant organizing across the United States is looking to us and saying, you know, what does it mean to take on the interests of capital, right? The people who make their money through capital gains. And win or lose, I think that that's an important thing that we have learned through this campaign is that it matters. It matters to say how we pay for this and that we are doing it because it is another form of inequity and wealth hoarding in our community. Mm-hmm.
Well, folks, we're going to head into our midway little break here. I'm Althea. Tammy's here with me. This is The Gap on KBOO Community Radio. We're speaking with Colleen Carroll and John Bethencourt from Eviction Representation for All. We're speaking about Multnomah County Measure 26238 in a few short minutes. You can call in at 503-231-8187 and ask questions of these lovely campaign coordinators and get some more info on this ballot measure. The number is 503-231-8187. If you got a question, give us a call. We're going to take a quick musical break and we'll be right back.
If I say I'm broke, not one red cent. It's no joke, no home, no food and no rent. When you say you're broke, you're really not. You call the cops and people like me get shot. I say I'm broke, it's pocket lint. Garner's wages, overdraft charges, every dollar spent. You looking down your nose like you think I don't belong. You call the police on us just for playing a song. Cost of living skyrockets, the prices are rising. Whether it's Clinton, Obama, Trump or Biden, first and last. And a damage deposit to compensate. They got me growing pot in my closet. They legalize it. And it's not surprising. My little operation is not so enterprising. I'm paying restitution for a previous charge. And we don't have a garage. No, not even a yard. Slipped in the parking lot on the black ice in the fog. Had to give up my cat and someone was keeping my dog.
I'm just a renter. This ain't my town. Might as well just burn it down. I care.
I'm just a tenant eating microwave dinner. I'm no competition for the money they're spending. I'm eating less, so you think I'd be thinner. These cheap carbohydrates keep on making me bigger. Diabetes, gout, hypertension. They want me out, I got my notice for eviction. I can't buy a house or afford where I'm living. My rent has more than doubled since last December.
I'm just a renter, this ain't my town.
Just a renter, Mike Crenshaw and David Rockvix. Am I saying that right? I hope I am. We are back here on The Gap on KBOO Portland. And the phone lines are open for you to call 503-231-8187. We are speaking with the volunteer campaign coordinators for Eviction Representation for All, aka ERA. And the phone lines are open for you to ask them your question about the upcoming measure that's in that's up for voting this month on the 16th, measure 26238. I'm here with Althea and the representatives, and we are waiting for your call.
The phone number is 503-231-8187. And look, you got to need a second to dial. I got plenty of other questions that we can use here to stall and to talk about, you know, what's been going on in this campaign as we are coming up rapidly on the May special election date. Now, one of the things that when we were discussing yesterday that I thought was really interesting was talking about kind of like the generational difference of what does, in terms of buying a house, renting, what does housing look like for younger generations versus 50, 60 years ago? And how does that inform this kind of work?
Yeah, I think that that's a really important question. The chances that many people will have will be able to be stably housed by owning a home of their own is gotten less and less possible. Through the hyper greedflation is a word that's been going around talking about like corporate profits, but I think it's been happening in housing for a long time, right?
Yeah.
A lot of us, you know, I remember the crash of 2008 and thinking, you know, it not only was like the burst of that capitalization bubble, but it was like the burst of a lot of people's dreams bubbles. Like we realized that story that we had been sold by our parents, and not, you know, maliciously, but was not going to be true for us, that more and more of us were going to be renters, long-time renters. And it turns out that long-time renters are the people who are the biggest threat to profit making by being a landlord. Mm-hmm. People who have lived in their rentals for a long time, renters are the way that we look at, you know, rental law and especially rent increase law, it is designed with the expectation that people can just pick up and move their lives at any time, right? That you can get a rent increase notice and it's like, whoa, you can't afford to live here. We'll just pack up your stuff and move.
Mm-hmm.
Not taking into account, right, where people work, where people send their kids to school, where, you know, where their community is based, and that we should, you know, renters should just be grateful to, you know, pack up and move. And so I think that generationally, it really matters to say the renters in this community are the people who are going to be impacted by this. And this measure was designed and written for you because you should be able to stay in the home that you're in.
Yeah, it shouldn't just be default that, you know, you get an eviction notice and it's over. I understand we have somebody on the line, Tammy.
That's right. Roger, you're on the air with us.
Oh, hi. Thanks for your show. It's always a great show. I had a couple of questions about this bill. I mean, not bill, this ballot measure. I got a flyer in the mail, which presumably came from the opposition, which asked some questions about it. But one of the things they mentioned is that the rate can be raised at any time in the future, and there's no limit on how much it can be raised. So the 0.75 percent could go up to, you know, whatever, and that concerns me. I was happy to hear that it wouldn't affect my IRA withdrawals because I'm going to be 72 this year, so I'm going to start having taking money out of my IRA, so that was good. But I do live on, you know, fairly low income. Now the one question I had was, he said that if a couple owns a house and sells it, there was a limit, I think, of $500,000 or something. What is it if an individual owns a house?
Yeah, I'm happy to take these. So I'll do the last one first. That's easy. For a single person, the limit is half. So it's a $250,000. So, you know, as an example, if, you know, you had a house that you bought for $400,000 as a single person and sold it for $850,000, then, you know, the profit from that sale is $450,000. So the first $250,000 of that would be untaxed, and then there would be $200,000 after that where you would pay capital gains tax, and, you know, with this measure it would have a small increase, 0.75%, so a little less than 1%. And that, yeah, so that brings me to the question of this tax being adjustable. So I should say, first of all, that when we wrote in the measure that the county is to adjust the tax over time as necessary to make sure the program is fully funded, technically that doesn't really do anything legally because the county commissioners can adjust any tax rate at any time. All taxes are adjustable. So telling them to take action to adjust it if they need to is just telling them to do something they can already do. But we thought that was important to put in there just to convey the idea that this is meant to be a permanently funded right to counsel, not just an attempt to throw a fixed amount of money at a problem and see if it's enough, but rather to say, look, we're going to pay what it takes to make sure that everyone in eviction court has legal representation, because we believe that's important. So, you know, there's a few ways this could go. You know, it's possible that, you know, a few years down the road, you know, the tax increase hasn't been taking on as much money as we thought, or the program has turned out to be a little more expensive than we thought. So maybe they would adjust the rate up to 1%. That would be a 30% increase, so a pretty big increase, but still a pretty low rate in the end, a 1% increase in the tax on capital gains. Or it could easily go the other way as well. We've seen in some jurisdictions with programs like this, eviction filings often drop a lot. So in New York, they saw a 40% drop in eviction filings after creating their program.
Whoa. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. And it's interesting. And these cases really represent cases where landlords knew they didn't have a legal cause for eviction. And previously, they would have just tried it anyway because they knew the tenant didn't know any better. But now that they know that the tenant has a lawyer, they didn't bother trying.
Yeah.
So we didn't bake any of that into our analysis. You know, our program is designed to process the number of evictions we're seeing right now, which is very high. If we see a drop like that here, then, you know, maybe down the road, the county commissioners end up lowering the tax rate to half of 1%, for instance.
Yeah. And I'll add, I think that it's important that the adjustable is coming out of the annual reports that the program itself gives, right? And so the county commissioners will have to justify any adjustment. And I think that, you know, the justification to raise the tax, that if they make that vote, is a harder bar to pass, right? Mm-hmm. They really will have to say, here's what we're, you know, what we're seeing and why the need. The justification to lower the tax based on saying it's working and there are less filings, less judgments of eviction, and a smaller need than originally anticipated, I think that's the easiest path for them to take.
Right.
And we wanted to make sure that that was available to them.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you, Roger, for calling. If other folks want to call in, we're talking to the campaign coordinators from Eviction Representation for All. The number is 503-231-8187. We got another caller on the line. Roberta, are you there? Can you hear us?
Yes, I'm here.
You're on the air. We'd love to hear your question.
Okay, my question is about who is going to collect the money, the tax. I see in the article that Street Roots wrote that our mayor thinks that the city's revenue division estimates that the administrative costs will take up 50% of the money. Are they the ones that are going to get the money? And how is it going to be audited? County or city?
Yeah, I'm happy to take that one as well. So like a lot of elements of this program, that's up to the Multnomah County Commissioners to decide as they implement the program. So they have contracted with the City of Portland Revenue Division to collect other local taxes in the past. So that's one possibility. And I read the report that the mayor had the Revenue Division produce. And I personally find that estimate very high. I think it's more of a worst case scenario, the $7 million a year in collection administration. If you read through that report, it's kind of filled with hedges saying like, well, we've budgeted this for a risk-related contingency. Costs could come in substantially below this. So I think a little bit of that is, you know, kind of civil servants looking to, you know, under-promise and over-deliver. And unfortunately, the mayor is also very closely aligned with our opposition. He's personally contributed to the No campaign. He's long been kind of closely allied with the Portland Business Alliance, who's leading the opposition. So, you know, I don't want to level accusations, but I also can't help but wonder if, you know, the person who produced that report was attempting to satisfy their boss, because of course they work for the mayor. But nevertheless, you know, even if it did end up costing that much, it's still not a lot of money in the grand scheme of things. If they increase the tax rate enough to fully cover that, then maybe it would end up at, you know, 1.1% instead of 0.75%. But there's another really important possibility that we've been working to highlight as much as possible, which is that this and other local taxes, and there are a few local taxes now, there's the Portland Arts Tax, Metro Supportive Housing Services Tax, the Preschool for All Income Tax, all of these could be easily consolidated into our state income tax return. So this is how it works in a number of other states that have both state and local taxes. Instead of having a separate system to file to a separate entity, these local taxes just become a line on the form, the state income tax return that you're already submitting. So there'll just be a box that says, check this box if you live in Multnomah County and then add this percentage. That's how it works in New York State, where I used to live, and a number of other places. So that would really be by far the most efficient option, and I hope that We do have some interest in the legislature in helping to make that happen, to have the Oregon Department of Revenue collect these local taxes just along with our state income taxes. And I think the expense for that would be very minimal.
Mm-hmm. And just talking about that report, I think one of the things that's also in that report is confirmation that this tax, you know, both what we've been saying and the city of Portland agrees that this tax will impact very, very few Multnomah County residents. Their projection is, and John will correct me if I'm wrong, it's less than 15% of taxpayers and less than 10% of residents. So again, the city of Portland agrees that this is going to impact very, very few taxpayers and residents.
Yeah, thank you for that explanation. Folks, we are talking with the volunteer campaign coordinators for Eviction Representation for All. If you would like to join some of the other callers that we've had and get some questions answered about, you know, what it would mean for you, how it would work, 503-231-8187 is the number to call, and we'll get you on air.
And I, as people start calling in, I have a question for you. What's it like having to go up against real estate developers and wealth management firms? Like, that's a lot of money. Like, what has that experience been like?
You described it as poking the bear yesterday, I think.
Yeah, I think the two campaigns are really a study in opposites. You know, on our side, we have basically nothing but grassroots people power. I think probably around 200 people have volunteered their time to work for free at one point or another over the last few years to help this campaign. We have a core team of about 20 people at any given time who are working on it nearly every single day, and zero paid staff at any point running the campaign. The only people we've ever paid were some of the signature gatherers. Much of the signature gathering was volunteer, but there was some paid signature gathering, and then we have an attorney for the, you know, the matters that we absolutely need her in court. And on the other side, it's exactly the opposite. They have zero volunteers, as far as I can tell. They have an enormous amount of money, like $600,000, much of it coming from these out-of-state business lobbying groups. And I think they have like two people who are just professional, you know, political consultants that they hired to just sit on this giant pot of money and churn out misinformation and fill everyone's mailboxes with it.
Yeah, I'll add to that. Yeah, this idea of poking the bear, it's something that, yeah, for the past 2 years, you know, again, I don't talk too often about this, but back in 2021, when I had been doing some tenant organizing and eviction court watch, I was served with an illegal eviction notice. And even though I had been already working in this work for a long, you know, or doing this work for a long time, I was terrified. And I was able to walk down to the management office and say, you know, this is an illegal notice of eviction. And their response to me was like, oh, oops, our bad, you know, and I took that day and I walked around to all of the, you know, I live in a large multifamily building and found about 40 other doors that had been served notices that day and knocked on all their doors, right? Like, that's the amount of time and energy and dedication, right, that we're doing kind of all of the time to you know, build community and make sure that us and each other are safe. And I just, you know, remember thinking I already knew about the idea of tenant right to counsel at that time when I was served with that illegal eviction notice. But more than anything, what I remembered is how scared I was. I was out of work. I have a young daughter. And that notice of termination is so terrifying. And in that moment, and in many, many moments, you know, since when I moved from just having to fight my landlord to say this is illegal, to moving and being a part of a coalition and an organizing effort to take on, yeah, the large financial interests and powerful players in not just in Oregon, but across the United States who have been, you know, funding this. It is terrifying. And I think that that's one of the things that I hold dearly about this campaign, because I've been listening. There's a singer, Jason Isbell, who's one of my very favorite singers and songwriters. And he has a song that says, be afraid and do it anyway. And I think about that. And I think about Miriam Kaba, who reminds us all of the time that hope is a discipline. We are not optimists. I think John and I are, and several of the people that we work on this campaign with are do not have a rosy view of the world, because we are living, you know, in a generational moment where I think about my daughter all of the time. I think about the world I'm gonna leave for her. And so I don't wake up hopeful, but I practice a discipline of being being willing to do the thing that I'm afraid of and doing it with other people. And that's one of the most important things about this campaign. And so, yeah, this idea that we have poked the bear, the financial bear, I just want people to know that whatever it is that you care really deeply about, you will face a bear and do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that.
We do have another caller. Francis, you're on the air with us.
Hi.
Hey, we'd love to hear your question.
Yeah, usually the big bad bears have some kind of vulnerability that we're not aware of. Anyway, my question is about how this is going to be distributed, the money, and who's it going to, and it's just for legal expenses, is that correct, for people who have been evicted or received notices?
Sure, I can talk a little bit about that. We're following, so the money is collected, and there are kind of primary things that it does. It funds a tenant resource office, so that's a new office that will manage the program and also provide outreach and education to tenants. So that's a countywide office. And then the county will contract with nonprofit law firms and community-based organizations to house the legal teams that will represent tenants who have been served with a notice of eviction. And that we built on this model in San Francisco, that instead of siloing the money into a single legal service provider or a place where people have to go and apply or make an application, that spreading the services out throughout the community to the organizations where people are already going when they get that notice of termination was a more successful outreach. And so it will be small legal teams of both lawyers, but paralegal professionals. And I think that's another important thing. The Oregon State Bar has made some changes this year to let paralegals represent tenants in eviction court. And so most of the day-to-day services will be done by the paralegals and outreach teams. And so much of the money is to provide those people with good paying salaried jobs where their caseloads are not overwhelming. I think that's one of the models we rejected was a caseload payment model and instead went with a salary based model. And so it will pay for the paralegal professional or professional paralegals, the managing lawyers and the tenant outreach teams in these no less than five community-based organizations and law firms. And then there is an additional set of pool of money that will that the legal teams can pull from when they're negotiating these stipulated agreements that we talked about. Those stipulated agreements can be very powerful eviction diversion tools if tenants are able to fulfill them. And that's one of the things that we see happen a lot right now in eviction court is people agree to something because they're being told in that minute, this is how you avoid an eviction today. So just sign this paper and agree to it. But they don't necessarily have a plan to meet that first payment plan. And so we've created a fund that would, the legal teams and the lawyers or and the tenants would be able to apply for a one-time payment to help make those stipulated agreements more durable while tenants get back on their feet, while they get a new job, while they wait for their paycheck. And that's a model. We modeled that based on some of the work that's done in Philadelphia and Washington, D.C. So that's one of the funds. And then there's also a separate fund that will help pay down the liens. Here in Oregon, the prevailing party, which is almost always landlords right now, but hopefully won't be forever, can pass their costs down to the non-winning side. And so right now what happens is tenants who get a judgment of eviction also get a court-ordered lien, and their wages can be garnished. Ooh. And those can be between $200 and up to $10,000. And those sit on your record, make it much harder to rent, make it harder to get a job. It's one of the other ways that administrative data and court records are really, really harmful to people who are trying to live their lives. And so, by paying down those liens, we will also. In fact, this is one of the benefits to landlords is that if you win a case fair and square, your lawyer against another lawyer, your legal fees will be paid down by the program as opposed to putting a lien on the tenant that sits there for 10 years and gets garnished 1 to 2 pennies at a time, that it will just pay it down. And so all together, the administrative costs, the cost of the legal services, and those two funds are what's going to get what will be paid for. And
okay, well, Francis, what do you think about that? You got a follow-up?
Yeah, I did. The lien is still exists. It's just you just get help paying it down. Is that what you're saying?
And once it's paid, it comes off your record, and that's the important thing.
So what do you mean by help paying it down? Do you pay it down, or you just help pay it down?
Oh, they would pay it. Yeah, they would pay it. Yes.
Okay, yeah. Because it sounds like the tenant themselves are still caught up in the dilemma. They're just getting help processing through it, it sounds like. So, but they're still caught up in the higher rents and all that. But they have someone to help them navigate through the system. But it's still, the process still exists as it is. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the process still exists. Okay. And they are able to take advantage of avoiding the least harmful outcomes, right? In eviction court, there are more harmful outcomes and less harmful outcomes. And so to divert and reduce the material and long-term impacts of eviction is what a lawyer really helps to do. And I agree. I think that there's a lot more work to be done. We have to address the massive amount of increases in rent locally. One of the things that Kansas City and other organizations who have passed Right to Counsel have said that this makes possible is more powerful tenant organizing. When we are not terrified of being evicted because we organize with our neighbors, when harassment and threats of eviction are less, credible because we know that we will have legal representation on our side, tenants have the opportunity to organize more. And tenant organizing is much like labor organizing is what, some of the next steps to a powerful tenant movement in Multnomah County to address some of the things, Francis, I think you're really saying, which is the system still really is hard for tenants. And I agree that this, but this will make it much like labor unions make it harder for bosses to terrify us and employers, having legal representation and knowing that a threat of eviction isn't a necessary, isn't an automatic eviction makes other types of organizing more possible.
Yeah. Well, thank you for calling, Francis.
Thank you.
Yeah. If other folks want to call, we got just a couple minutes left. 503-231-8187 is the number. If you're a renter, maybe you got questions about this.
Renters to the front.
Renters to the front. 503-231-8187. While we wait for that, how can folks get involved?
I'm glad you asked. I was hoping to pipe up about that. So we are working very hard every day through the election to beat those very very full pockets of real estate interests who are pushing out a lot of misinformation about this, and all we have to rely on is our people power. So we're knocking doors and we're phone banking almost every single day through the election on Tuesday the 16th. Tomorrow morning we're meeting at Brentwood Park in the southeast near Lentz at 11 a.m. I'll be there. You can find all this stuff on our website, eratenants.org, but you can RSVP ahead of time if you want to, but you don't have to. So yeah, if you want to help us knock doors and talk to people, show up at 11 a.m. at Brentwood Park tomorrow. We'll give you a little training, get you all up to speed on everything you need, and give you the materials you'll need. And we'll be doing that again Sunday at 11 a.m. at Glenhaven Park. On Sunday, we also have a phone bank at 3 p.m. that you can do from home. Again, you can find the details of that on our calendar, on our website. And yeah, so check out those events. Tell your friends to vote. We are expecting this to be a very low turnout election. Probably about a quarter or less of registered voters will bother returning their ballot. So, if you just spread the word to the people you know and make sure they get that in with a yes vote on Measure 26-238, even if they don't have time to look at anything else on there, that could really easily make the difference.
Yeah, you don't have to fill out the whole ballot. People forget that sometimes.
Yeah, I think I was just going to reiterate that, which is, a lot of the coverage of this campaign has not considered the fact that there are more renters in Multnomah County than not, and that we make up a huge, we make up the majority of the people who work and are participating in the community here, right? I think obviously homeowners matter, but renters have seemed to not matter in the coverage of this campaign. And so I just want to take a minute and say, if you're a renter in this community, please participate and talk to your friends, talk to your neighbors, talk to the other people you know who rent, because likely there's lots of people, and say, this is something that protects us. This is something that other renters have done locally to address some of the inequities in our system, and that, as a renter, I think it was the very last line of that song we were just listening to is like, there's this perception that renters, aren't as committed to the city as homeowners, because what, we don't have some stake in it. And I think that that's absolute BS. It's like, stand up as a renter and say, yes, I demand more from the county and I demand more from the city in terms of making sure that I can continue to live and work and thrive here.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank you both so much for taking the time to speak with us, Colleen Carroll and John Bethencourt from Eviction Representation for All, speaking with us about Measure 26238. They're online at eratenants.org. Okay.
That's right.
Fabulous. This has been The Gap. I'm Althea. Tammy's been here with me. Thank you all so much for listening. Remember to vote. And we'll see you back here next week.
See ya.
Bye.
This is KBOO Portland, volunteer-powered community radio.
Friday, May 5th, is the National Day of Awareness for Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls. It's a day that calls for justice for those mothers, daughters, and sisters that go missing from Indigenous communities and reservations. Tune in to KBOO Friday, May 5th at 6 p.m. for special programming on Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women Awareness Day, produced by KBOO's Carmen Garnica.
Can't get good reception of KBOO on your radio? Just type in www.kboo.fm on your PC or laptop and click on Listen Live. We're just a mouse click away.
Today from the Wings Archives, Debt as Warfare.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by